John Wesley Harding was a friend to the poor. He traveled with a gun in every hand. All along this countryside he opened many a door, but he was never known to hurt an honest man. Was down in Cheney County a time they talk about. With his lady by his side he took a stand, and soon the situation there was all but straightened out. For he was always known to lend a helping hand. All across the telegraph his name it did resound, but no charge held against him could they prove, and there was no man around who could track or chain him down. He was never known to make a foolish move.
Bob Dylan with John Wesley Harding. Hello and welcome to American Hit Radio here on WHPC 90.3 FM. Friday at 5 p.m., we have our series which we call How Music Changed, where we feature influential artists from the past 100 years, and for about the past 50 years, we've been covering Bob Dylan. It feels that way anyway. We're on our on our ninth Dylan show now. This is nine shows into Dylan's career that we've been covering. Actually,
otherwise known as part I.
Yes, right. The ninth letter. Heidi says that because actually you can find all of these shows. We're saving them on the web at our website, shutupandlisten.com, shadupandlisten. .com. And if you go there, we have them all segregated by, you know, A, B, C, D, E, so you could basically keep track of them. Because this is, Dylan is artist number 133 of our series of 250 artists that we are going to be covering in this series of How Music Changed. And at this rate, I think it's a career for me. I think if I can dig up 20 shows on Dylan, I'm good for about another 12 or 15 years of these shows, I think. We'll make
and
it last.
None will be repeated.
Right, without repeating anything, which is great. I mean, I hope you had a chance to listen so far with what we've covered for Dylan. I mean, being as influential as he is, we're having nothing but fun, really, like digging into what his career has been and how it developed. And with today's show, as you could tell by our lead-off track, we are covering the late 1967, actually the rest of the 60s of his career, the latter part of the 60s of Dylan's career. It's the ninth show. It's the album John Wesley Harding is going to be the focus of our attention for the first portion of the show. And I'm not sure if you were able to catch our show on Tuesday. We actually moved a segment of How Music Changed to Tuesday this week to help move the series along a little bit, since there's so many Dylan shows to be done. But if you did miss it, but but you were here listening on Friday sequentially, you were actually going to be hearing something which is going to sound more like what really happened. You see, on Tuesday, what we covered was the basement tapes. And we covered them in the chronological order that they happened. But the fact of the matter is, the public really wasn't hearing them at the time that they happened. So what the public really heard was a lot of dead air. There was no Dylan from the end of Blonde on Blonde until the end of 1967. And that year and a half.
Is that what we're picking up now?
And that's exactly where we are now. This
okay.
is the sequentially the album that followed Blonde on Blonde would be John Wesley Harding, with one exception. And that is this. Columbia was getting restless because they were used to Dylan delivering one genius album after another, which is why up to this point, here we are on our ninth show and we're covering Dylan's eighth album. You could, just to put it in perspective. I mean, there was a lot of genius to be covered there in the 60s. But just before the release of John Wesley Harding as an album, Columbia just saw fit to release Dylan's first greatest hits collection. It was essentially a collection of all of his singles, with a few key album tracks, only a few.
That was to appease all the people that hated him but loved him.
Exactly.
Well, in their hearts.
Yeah, and it also compiled all Dylan from the earliest up until Blonde on Blonde on one album. And it was almost like putting together the music from like four or five different artists because he changed so often in that period of time. And it sold like hotcakes, despite the fact that it was the very first album released by Columbia with a $5.98 list price. Before that, albums were $4.98 list. So this was the price. This is the album that kicked off the price hike for Columbia Records.
They were bilking the public. They knew that they wanted it.
They absolutely did know that they wanted it, and it sold great, continues to sell great. It's one of the best catalog albums that Columbia ever had.
But you can't get it for $5.98 anymore.
No, you cannot. Good point. Exactly. Well, finally, though, at the end of 1967, the whole Summer of Love passed with Dylan being quiet as a mouse, not releasing anything, and this curious album comes out around Christmas of 1967 called John Wesley Harding, and it's really just Dylan, a drummer, and a bass player. Three people, really, on the entire album. Two tracks have a pedal steel on added to the mix, but really, for the most part, the album is a three-piece band moving through these very simple country-style songs, but with these really evocative lyrics. All of the lyrics seem to come from either old Americana or the Bible. And the imagery is intense, and this is what would keep people talking about this album for a long time. It's not what, again, with the way Dylan's constantly surprising his fans, again, it was not what anybody expected. I guess here
all the best artists do that.
Sure, but here we are in the midst of the Summer of Love and psychedelia. Rock and roll is developing a very, very strong personality of its own, and the youth movement is becoming incredibly strong and really has moved to the forefront of what the entire music industry is about. Dylan, who had been the person who more or less helped push that boulder up the hill, is now running away from the movement entirely. And while Jimi Hendrix and Cream and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and everybody else are enjoying this huge heyday of incredible success with this whole youth movement and rock and roll becoming the most important music, Dylan is moving far away from it. The track that we heard just now to open the show was the title track from the album called John Wesley Harding. Rather odd because there was a mythic figure, a real figure actually, a folk figure named John Wesley Hardin without the G, who was well known, I guess, or really maybe not well known, but was a figure of some renown. So, Dylan basically apparently based the song on him, and we don't know why he added the G, or whether he just thought that that's who it was. I don't know.
Artistic license.
Exactly. But it was one of those situations where, I mean, again, in the lyrics of that song, it's so strange because, well, this is what Dylan says about it. I was going to write a ballad on, like, maybe one of those old cowboy, a real long ballad. But in the middle of the second verse, I got tired. I had a tune and I didn't want to waste the tune. It was a nice little melody. So I just wrote a quick third verse and I recorded that. I knew people were going to listen to that song and say that they didn't understand what was going on, but they would have singled that song out later if we hadn't called the album John Wesley Harding and placed so much importance on that for people to start wondering about it. If that hadn't have been done, the song would have come up and people would have said it was a throwaway song. I wonder if he's right. The thing about that song that really captures my attention is he's telling the story and he really doesn't seem to want to waste too much of his time on meaningless detail. Like he's not writing 15 verses anymore in a single song. He's got this song pretty much culled down. And in the third verse, he more or less sums up the situation with a line that is almost like a total, huh? Like he says, and soon the situation there was all but straightened out. We didn't even know what the situation was in the first place. So, I mean, really, here's Dylan just cutting to the chase all of a sudden lyrically and leaving you to fill in the blanks and wonder who are all these characters that are popping up in these songs. Here's another example of that, actually. Here's another track from the album, John Wesley Harding. This one is entitled As I Went Out One Morning.
As I went out one morning to breathe the air around Tom Paine's, I spied the fairest damsel that ever did walk in chains. I offered her my hand, she took me by the arm. I knew that very instant she meant to do me harm. Depart from me this moment, I told her with my voice. Said she, but I don't wish to. Said I, but you have no choice. I beg you, sir, she pleaded from the corners of her mouth. I will secretly accept you, and together we'll fly south. Just then Tom Paine himself came running from across the field, shouting at this lovely girl and commanding her to yield. And as she was letting go her grip, up Tom Paine did run. I'm sorry, sir, he said to me, I'm sorry for what she's done.
As I Went Out One Morning. It's Bob Dylan, of course, taken from the album John Wesley Harding, released in late 1967, just around Christmas time. According to Robbie Robertson, he said that as he recalled, remember now, Dylan was living in upstate New York near Woodstock at this time, married happily, and not very interested in returning to the music industry, really. But so that's why he was up there playing with the band and just more or less having relaxed sessions with them. But according to Robbie Robertson, his quote is, as I recall it, it was just on a kind of whim that Bob went down to Nashville. And there, with just a couple of guys, he put those songs down on tape. In actuality, Dylan went down in around this time of year in 1967, late summer and autumn. And he required like only 12 hours to record the entire album. He went to the studio, three separate four-hour sessions, recorded the entire album in a total of 12 hours. Did the whole thing with two session players, Kenny Buttrey was the drummer, and Charlie McCoy was the bass player.
Well, he always got like a strong image of what he wanted something to sound like, and if the players could figure it out easily, it doesn't take him long to record.
Generally, yes, that's right. But there's so many different phases of Dylan and Dylan's attitude toward his own music that even that changes. Up until this point, though, of his career, I'd say that's exactly right. You know, he had a very strong idea of what he wanted people to play and who he wanted to do it, and his strong will really carried him through. Right around here, though, you'll almost notice that there's a certain tentative sense about his demeanor, even in the way that he's singing the songs. It sounds like it's a different person than the guy who sang Blonde on Blonde. And that in itself is pretty remarkable. Like, all of a sudden, where did this come from? Who is this guy? Here he is away from the scene for about, not quite 2 years, maybe 18 or 20 months. And when he reemerges, that cocky, headstrong guy who is trying to, you know, almost force feed his audience to accept what he was doing when he was on tour with the Hawks, or soon to be the band, is now singing these really mellow songs with all of this strange religious imagery. And he's singing it in such a mellow, quiet way that it sounds like he's even like more shy than he was on the very first album that he released back in 1962. Maybe shy is the wrong word, but withdrawn might be a better word. I'm not even too sure if he sounds like he's as certain of himself. I think that he, on some deep internal level, feels less secure in where he is headed in the music industry. I think that he's very comfortable with his private life. He's married. He's got kids. He's reflecting on that and feeling that maybe that's where his energy really belongs. And this whole music industry thing apparently seemed like nothing more than a huge distraction, full of leeches and hangers-on. And he has fans who are coming up to his house on an almost daily basis. He's finding them on his property. He's finding them in his house. They're harassing
him. Time to get a shotgun.
Endlessly. And he's like, you know, these are my fans? Because how could these people be my fans? He needs to get away from this. So he eventually decides at one point that he even has to leave Woodstock to get away from it. And he, of course, made the mistake of moving back to Greenwich Village, which didn't help the situation whatsoever. But when you got to be as famous as Dylan was and a reluctant figurehead like Dylan was, it was pretty much unavoidable to have the situation. And everybody wanted to find out what he was about. And when he went missing, he was the guy to find. So it was almost like a J.D. Salinger situation, I presume, at this point in 1967. And when he comes out with this very mysterious album full of all this, with these songs with apparently deep underlying meanings, there was an awful lot to be considered. Take, for instance, this next song from the same album and just see if you could try to figure out for yourself. It just begs you to read between the lines on a song like this. This one is entitled, I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine.
St. Augustine, alive as you are me, tearing through these quarters in the utmost misery, with a blanket underneath his arm and a coat of solid gold, searching for the very souls whom already have been sold. Arise, arise, he cried so loud with a voice without restraint. Come out, ye gifted kings and queens, and hear my sad complaint. No martyr is among ye now whom ye can call your own, but go on your way accordingly, but know you're not alone. Fiery breath and and I dreamed I was amongst the ones that put him out to death. Oh, I awoke in anger, so alone and terrified. I put my fingers against the glass and bowed my head and prayed.
One sign of Bob Dylan's hesitancy toward, you know, getting active again in the music industry with John Wesley Harding was the way that he approached his record company about how he wanted to handle its promotion. First of all, he said that he was dead set against there being any single from the album at all. And he said, his quote was, he said, "I asked Columbia to release it with no publicity and no hype because this was the season of hype." Which he's kind of right. If you think about it, the way everything was happening, everything was getting pushed to that point where everything was all about the commercial and how much airplay you could get. And Dylan wasn't
and
really
was there any scandal of payola at this time?
In 67, not that I can think of, no.
Okay, just
no,
wondering.
No, I mean, FM radio was becoming huge. That was one thing that was happening. And Dylan's album would fit beautifully in terms of like the way that FM radio was accepting mm-hmm. of different things. So he was actually seeing some airplay, but not as much as he could have had he fit into that whole rock and roll groove that he had helped establish.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that, you know, when you're pulling away toward country and radio stations are trying to establish some sort of a stylistic foothold, you got to, as we know today, you more or less stick to what it is that you do best.
Formats.
And even in the earliest days when radio was at its loosest, you know, Dylan would get airplay, but not as much as his earlier stuff probably would have. Like the Blonde on Blonde era, Dylan was probably still seeing regular airplay. But albums like this were a little bit tougher to get onto the radio. This next track was probably the song that would have been most likely to be released as a single by Dylan. And this also is a really good example of what Dylan was about. Here in the most simplest of forms is a song where the lyrics are essentially tell a story backward. They start at the end, and if you follow it, you'll notice that as you move through it, the last verse is the first verse, and it kind of sets it up. I didn't know that until it was told to me, and then I heard it again. I was like, wow, that's really cool. It makes sense that way. If you listen to All Along the Watchtower backward, it tells a pretty logical story. So think of it as like a movie in a time with a time warp where you're seeing the end before the beginning and it makes some sense. And then apply that. Now you're talking about Dylan's simple bass and drums version of this song with his own acoustic guitar. And then imagine Jimi Hendrix hearing this for the first time and saying, I could do something with that. And then Hendrix goes into the studio pretty much as a solo artist, plays virtually every single instrument on his version except for the drums, I believe, and turns it into this absolutely phenomenal rock and roll symphony. To this day, one of the most intensely perfect rock and roll productions ever made by anybody. And it goes to show you what could have been done if Dylan decided to be contemporary, but that's not where his head was at. He was basically about stripping it down, keeping it simple. Here's my words. Here's Dylan's version, the original version of All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. thief he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now. The hour is getting late. All along the watchtower, princes kept the view. While all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
Notice how at the end of the song, they're sitting around with two riders approaching and the wind begins to howl. And then, but then you think back to the first verse and they said, there must be some way out of here. Mm-hmm. They're trapped in the beginning. At the end of the song, this is two riders approaching. So you could just tell there's something about that story. What Dylan said at the time was, what I'm trying to do now is not use too many words. There's no line that you can stick your finger through. There's no hole in any of the stanzas. There's no blank filler. Each line has something. And you can tell that there's a certain economy in Dylan's style now that's drastically different than what he was doing around, say, Highway 61 or Desolation Row, and where he would write these very gorgeous,
like
but
epics.
Epic 11, 12-minute songs with 16, 17, 18 verses that just go on and on and on, like almost like free-form poetry. Here, these things are very condensed, very tight, and it's up to the listener to more or less weave something out of them. That might very well be one of the most covered songs of the rock and roll era, Along the Watchtower. So many people have had great success with covering it from, I mean, my gosh, U2, Dave Matthews, of course, as well. Gigantic acts. You know, some of the biggest acts in the world have covered that song and have had great luck with their versions of it. It's also been noted on this album that there's a man named Bert Cartwright who did a study on this album, wrote a book called it The Bible and the Lyrics of Bob Dylan. And he cites more than 60 biblical allusions in the course of this album, saying at this time, Dylan's own mother said that if you went to his house in Woodstock, he had like a podium or a pedestal where he kept the Bible there for reference, and he'd constantly be going over to it and referring to the Bible for whatever he was, for his thought patterns, for his writing. It was just something that he was utilizing quite a bit at this time in the late 60s. And apparently, it was obviously coming out in his songs and in his lyrics, probably none more so than in this next song. This track is called The Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest. This man, Bert Cartwright, counts 15 separate biblical allusions in this one track.
Well, Frankie Lee and Judas Priest, they were the best of friends. So when Frankie Lee needed money one day, Judas quickly pulled out a roll of tens and placed them on a footstool just above the potty plane, saying, take your pick, Frankie boy, my loss will be your gain. Well, Frankie Lee, he sat right down and put his fingers to his chin, but with the cold eyes of Judas on him, his head began to spin. Could you please not stare at me like that, he said, it's just my foolish pride. But sometimes a man must be alone, and this is no place to hide. Well, Judas, he just winked and said, all right, I'll leave you here, but you better hurry up and choose which of those bills you want before they all disappear.
I'm gonna start my picking right now. Just tell me where you'll be. Judas pointed down the road and said, eternity. Eternity, said Frankie Lee, with a voice as cold as ice. That's right, said Judas, eternity, though you might call it paradise. I don't call it anything, said Frankie Lee with a smile. All right, said Judas Priest, I'll see you after a while. Well, Frankie Lee, he sat back down, feeling low and mean. When just then a passing stranger burst upon the scene, saying, are you Frankie Lee, the gambler, whose father's deceased? Well, if you are, there's a fella calling you down the road, and they say his name is Priest. Oh, yes, he is my friend, said Frankie Lee in fright. I do recall him very well, in fact, he just left my sight. Yes, that's the one, said the stranger, as quiet as a mouse. Well, my message is he's down the road, stranded in a house. Well, Frankie Lee, he panicked, he dropped everything and ran, until he came onto the spot where Judas Priest did stand. What kind of house is this, he said, where I have come to roam? It's not a house, says Judas Priest, it's not a house, it's a home. Well, Frankie Lee, he trembled, he soon lost all control over everything which he had made while the mission bells did toll. He just stood there staring at that big house as bright as any sun, with 24 windows and a woman's face in every one. Well, up the stairs ran Frankie Lee with a soulful bounding leap, and foaming at the mouth, he began to make his midnight creep. For 16 nights and days he raved, but on the 17th he burst into the arms of Judas Priest, which is where he died of thirst. No one tried to say a thing when they carried him out in jest, except of course the little neighbor boy who carried him to rest. Just walked along alone with his guilt so well concealed, and muttered underneath his breath, nothing is revealed. Well, the moral of the story, the moral of this song, is simply that one should never be where one does not belong. So when you see your neighbor carrying something, help him with his load, and don't go mistaking paradise for that home across the road.
Well, if you can imagine, nothing was revealed, indeed. Here it is, 40 years later, and that song is still a mystery, but people are still trying to analyze it, I'm sure. It's a parable song with a distinct moral, which is unusual for Dylan, but there it is. That's called The Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest. A couple more songs I want to play from this album, so let me get right to the next one. I think this one's a bit more direct in its intent. It's entitled Dear Landlord.
Don't put a price on my soul. My burden is heavy, my dreams are beyond control. When that steam
but whistle blows. I'm gonna give you all I got to give, and I do hope you receive it well, depending on the way you feel that you live. Dear landlord, please heed these words that I speak. I know you've suffered much, but in this you are not so unique. All of us at times we might work too hard, too heavy, too fast, and too much. And anyone can fill his life up with things he can see, but it just cannot touch. Dear landlord, please don't dismiss my case. I'm not about to argue, I'm not about to move to no other place. Now each of us has his own special gift, and you know this was meant to be true. And if you don't underestimate me, I won't underestimate you.
That song made me think about the similarities that Bob Dylan has with John Lennon.
I can hear that really well.
Stylistically, like in the song.
Like the Plastic Ono Band album where Dylan had, where Lennon was keeping things very simple as well. That sounds very similar to that. And the way that it's about, like Lennon did that song about the working class hero. And it definitely seems to be some similarity there. It's very insightful, along with their love of New York as well.
Right.
It's very interesting.
Yep.
Let's play the last track from this album before we move on to the next. This is the first show we're going to actually cover two albums. It's amazing up to this point.
You can see, I'm freaking.
We're moving along.
We're making
progress here.
I'm getting nervous.
Well, here's the way the album John Wesley Harding closed out. A fairly direct, straightforward song by Dylan standards, absolutely straightforward, entitled I'll Be Your Baby Tonight.
Sail away, we're gonna forget it, That big fat moon, he's gonna shine like a spoon, but we're gonna let it, you won't regret it. Kick your shoes off, do not fear. Bring that bottle over here. I'll be your baby tonight. You
know, in 1967, Dylan was probably the only human being on the planet Earth who could rhyme the words moon and spoon and be taken seriously.
Well, and be taken seriously, okay.
Just I'm glad anybody you could do that. It. But, yeah, but anybody else would have been laughed at. Nobody was laughing at Dylan in 1967. In fact, they probably figured that he did it on quite deliberately.
Right.
In order to make a statement almost about what he was doing lyrically. That big old moon's going to shine like a spoon. Yeah, it's incredible. Well, it's at this point, it was about 18, almost 2 years, a year and a half, 2 years before, since Dylan's last live appearance. But he put word out, he heard that Woody Guthrie had passed away. Obviously, he was quite influenced by Woody Guthrie. And he put word out that he would be willing to play at any memorial show if one was planned. And one did take place on January 20th, 1968. He played with Woody Guthrie's son Arlo, and Tom Paxton and Judy Garland played. Dylan performed with the band. They only played three songs at that performance in New York City, and that would be Dylan's last performance for another 18 months. So if you wanted to see Bob Dylan live, there were no tours. That's 3 years up to that point now with only one performance in that entire time period by Dylan. Now, as 1967 comes to a close, something happens. And this is Dylan's quote. "One day I was half-stepping and the lights went out, and since that point I more or less had amnesia. It took me a long time to get to do consciously what I used to be able to do unconsciously." He just really removed himself even further from the music industry. His father had passed away. His wife had their third child. Plus, I think he had a fourth that he had adopted. So the music industry wasn't really his concern. 1968 pretty much goes by again. An entire year passes. And finally, in 1969, in April 9th, 1969, he releases his ninth album called Nashville Skyline. And it's even further away from where rock and roll is headed than his previous album. You might remember it by the hit single, though, that was taken from the album. Here's Dylan with a brand new voice besides wherever this came from. Who knows? But here's Bob Dylan with this new crooning voice singing Lay Lady Lay.
Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Whatever colors you have in your mind, I show them to you, and you see them shine. Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Stay, lady, stay, stay with your man a while. Until the break of day, let me see you make 'em smile. His clothes are dirty, but his hands are clean. And you're the best thing that he's ever seen. Stay, lady, stay. Stay with your man a while. need to. Why wait any longer for the one you love when he's standing in front of you? Lay, 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 lay across my big breast bed. Stay, lady, stay. Stay while the night is still ahead. I long to see you in the morning light. I long to reach for you in the night. Stay, lady, stay. Stay while the night is still ahead.
It was a top 10 hit for Bob Dylan in 1969.
That
song was written.
Can't beat that pedal steel.
It's beautiful, isn't it? That song was actually written for the movie Midnight Cowboy. But Dylan was too slow to deliver it, so they picked up Harry Nilsson's song, Everybody's Talking, instead. I got to read the story because it's just such a great story about the song. This is by the drummer, Kenny Buttrey. He goes, sometimes I go to the artist and say, what do you hear on the drums? Because sometimes when people write songs, they can hear it completed. They hear everything that they think's going to be on it. I went over to Dylan and said, I'm having a little trouble here thinking of something to play. Do you have any ideas? He said, bongos. I immediately disregarded that. I couldn't hear bongos in this thing at all. So I walked into the control room and said to the producer, Bob Johnston, you know, what do you hear regards to drums on this thing? And he said, cowbells. Chris Christopherson was working at Columbia Studios at that time as a janitor, and he had just emptied my ashtray at the drums. And I said, Chris, do me a favor here. Hold these two things. Hold these bongos in one hand and hold the cowbells in the other. And I swung this mic over to the cowbells and the bongos. I had no pattern or anything worked out. I just said to Chris, this is one of those spite deals. I'm going to show them just how bad their ideas really are. So we started to play the tune, and I was just doodling around on these bongos and the cowbells, and it was kind of working out pretty cool. Comes chorus time, I'd go to the set of drums. Next time you hear that cut, listen to how far off mic the drums sound. There were no mics on the drums. It was just leakage. But it worked out pretty good. To this day, it's one of the best drum patterns I ever came up with.
Cool.
Is that a cool story?
That's cool.
Especially thinking about Chris Christopherson being there and his, like, you
right,
know,
being the
janitor outfit
and
everything before he got recognized.
Thing.
What a world, huh? Well, the album was so different for Dylan because, I mean, it had instrumental tracks on it. It leads off with another version of Girl from North Country, a track that Dylan had already released earlier in his career, doing a duet with Johnny Cash. But it's this really laconic, slow version. It doesn't really go anywhere. It's a bit charming because it's Dylan and Johnny Cash.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an odd way to lead off a brand new studio album. And it just made you think, like, oh, where's this album going? Here's an example, because Dylan's writing around this time. You can tell that something's going on and maybe things aren't quite right, but some of it they've all got a charm of their own. Here's one of the other more interesting songs from the album. This one is titled, I Threw It All Away.
Held her in my arms. She said she would always stay. But I was cruel, I treated her like a fool. I threw it all away. Once I hit mountains in the palm of my hand, and rivers that ran through every day. But I must have been mad, I never knew what I had until I threw it all away. Love is all that is, it makes the world go round. Love and only love, it can't be denied. No matter what you think about it, you just won't be able to do without it.
take a tip from one who's tried. So if you find someone who gives you all of the love, take it to your heart, don't let it stray. Oh, one thing for certain, you will surely be a hurtin' if you throw it all away. If you throw it all away.
Here's three things to think about when you listen to this album, Nashville Skyline. The first one is how strange it is that he suddenly adopts this affected croon. How odd that is, that it just comes almost out of nowhere. I mean, it has been, granted, 20 months or almost 2 years since his previous album, so he had time.
Each time he comes out with a new persona, so to speak.
Yeah, is this the same guy?
Personas are unnamed, and unlike David Bowie.
Right, and with him not playing live. It's people have got to be scared. Who is that's Bob Dylan? Get out. That's crazy. The other thing is, how weird is it that, I mean, the album's called Nashville Skyline, and he's playing this real, you know, Nashville-style country music. And Nashville wasn't really cool by rock and roll standards in 1969 at all. You know, I mean, that stuff really wasn't
it. But he's really being true to himself in that he really likes a lot of folky stuff. So.
Everybody else was more or less following where things were going. The rock and roll artists were all linked together. Follow this thing forward, this youth movement thing, and, you know, go to this brave new world wherever rock and roll is headed. And Dylan had nothing to do with that. I mean, country music was cool, but the Nashville version of country was establishment, and rock and roll was anti-establishment. So here's Dylan, like, almost aligning himself with this establishment sound. So that was weirding people out. And the third thing is, think of the times. Think of what was happening in 1969. Let's see, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was assassinated. There's riots all over the place in Chicago and Detroit. Richard Nixon is reinstated into the presidency in 1969. The Vietnam War is going strong with revolts and riots at the Democratic Convention. The country was a mess. And Bob Dylan, who was this leader in a sense, well, not that he ever thought of himself that way, but he was who people thought of as this spokesman of the early 60s, 63, 64, for civil rights and everything. And here he is playing these songs in Nashville, having nothing at all to do with what's happening in that scene. This is why people were hounding him and driving him crazy. And what is his response? He writes songs like check this one out. This song just almost cracks me up. I can't even believe that it's on this album. Here's Bob Dylan singing. We'll play the whole thing, but I want you to listen to the lyrics of this track, and you tell me if you think the man is serious. Here's Dylan singing Peggy Day.
Peggy Day stole my poor heart away. By golly, what more can I say? Love to spend the night with Peggy Day. Peggy night make my future look so bright. Man, that girl is out of sight. Love to spend the day with Peggy night.
You see what I'm saying?
It's just a goofy song.
It's like, you know, there's a song in here about country pie. Bob Dylan singing about good old country pie, you know? It's just so odd to hear this coming from Bob Dylan. And it had a lot of people scratching their heads. Critics were divided on this album. Some of them basically just took it at face value and said, this is really not the Bob that we know. This is ridiculous. Another said, you know, he's reinventing himself again. Let it, you know, and he's going against trends and he's being unique. And both of those things are true. So the album ended up having some critical value. Where we go in our next show on Dylan, by the way, is pretty much where no artist ever wants to ever go. The place where every critic in the world agrees that your music totally sucks. And that's what happened to Bob Dylan after this period.
I thought we were
album.
Having a Star Trek moment there.
We'll be covering that aspect of Dylan's career on our next show on Tuesday. At 5 p.m. coming up, where we cover the dreaded self-portrait album and that era, that portion of his career, the early 70s. But meanwhile, let's hear the last track from Nashville Skyline. It's another song very much like the way that he ended John Wesley Harding with I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. This song is sort of reminiscent of that again. This one ends Nashville Skyline, and it's entitled Tonight I'll Be Staying Here With You.
Out there too. Throw my troubles out the door. I don't need them anymore. Cause tonight I'll be staying here with you. I should have left this town this morning, but it was more than I could do. Oh, your love comes on so strong, and I've waited all day long for tonight when I'll be staying here with you. Is it really any wonder the love that a stranger might receive? You cast your spell and I went under. I find it so difficult to leave. I can hear that whistle blowing. I see that station master too. If there's a poor boy on the street, then let him have my seat. Cause tonight I'll be staying here with you.
We're laughing off mic because Heidi rather astutely pointed out that it might not ever be a good idea to tell your audience that your next show is really going to suck. So maybe I should recount that a little bit and say that on our next show on Tuesday, we are going to attempt to find the most redeeming values of Dylan's music from the early 70s. We've got four albums that we get to pick from. We're going to actually cover four separate albums in our show.
So there's bound to be something good when you're talking Dylan.
Four albums. I'm sure we can find highlights there.
Right.
In our search for Dylan's brightest moments from that era. It will be an interesting show. I promise you that. I promise that it will be extremely interesting. If you can join us this coming Tuesday at 5 p.m. for our 10th show in our series on Bob Dylan. And of course,
otherwise known as Jay.
Show Jay. And of course, we'll be back on Friday with the continuing series and show number 11. So thank you once again for listening, everyone. And we'll see you hopefully on Tuesday and next Friday at 5 p.m. Bye, Heidi. Thank you, Earl.
Bye. Thank you.
All down her breast, see for me that her hair's hanging down. That's the way I remember her best.